The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate, increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
Welcome to Rideau Recognition Radio, the show that's all about building relationships, inspiring greatness, and creating a workplace where people can thrive. I'm Max Brown, along with my colleague and friend, Roy Saunderson, and we're from the Rideau Recognition Institute. Roy, I'm excited about a very special show today. How about you?
Absolutely. When I think about having hope in today's world with all its challenges, I think today's show is just the epitome of how we can maintain that hope, even in our most difficult challenges of life.
Well, and for me, to take that a step further, you know, when I think about challenges in my own life, and then I think about the perspective of the one we're about to hear, it starts to, make my own trials sound like, what am I complaining about?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, well, our guest today is Caroline Stessinger, author of A Century of Wisdom: Lessons from the Life of Alice Hertz Sommer, the world's oldest living Holocaust survivor. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe she's now 108 years old. Caroline met Alice in London in 2004, where Alice spoke to her of music as the as it's our food, basic to our education and to our well-being, and that we are a global society and music is the only language that needs no translation. Inspired by Alice's story and profound belief in music, Caroline wrote her recent story, A Century of Wisdom. She is an author and a pianist, and she's the artistic director of the chamber music at the Tillis Center and artist in residence at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She's a specialist in the Theron Saad composers, and she produced the 2007 New York tribute to Alice with Lynn Redgrave and George Hearn in the 2004 revival of Brundibar, the children's opera performed in the concentration camp, and is working on a documentary film about Alice's life. Caroline, we are so grateful you could be on our show today.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
We are delighted. And I just want to start with, why this book? Why were you drawn to a story like this, particularly around Alice's story?
I believe that we understand history, philosophy, psychology, just about everything better through the eyes and lips of one individual and one life, as opposed to masses of statistics. And music of the Holocaust has been my academic specialty for a long, long time. And I've been fascinated, partly because of my own background and the background of relatives, of particularly the music of Theresienstadt and the fact that there were concerts in a concentration camp. In fact, all the camps had concerts of one sort or another.
Mm.
And it's such a bizarre story and such a topsy-turvy story in the midst of all of this. And I have studied it most of my life. Alice is one of the last of the survivors who really was able to practice her music and who survived to tell the story. And I've been interested in her for many, many, many years, but not nearly so interested as when I met her. And she inspired me to really live on a different level.
Wow. I love this idea that you talk about, instead of looking at stats and big numbers for figuring out life, to look at the individual story. What a wonderful place to talk about it. Can you tell us more about her life and what drew you in?
Well, first of all, Alice comes from a world that, in my imagination, particularly as an early teenager, I think I lived in. It was the world of the late 19th and early 20th century, where writers like Stefan Zweig and Rilke and Thomas Mann were really in their heyday. And it was a literature that I loved very much. Also, that people went to concerts continually. A concert was a great experience. It was something. You didn't just go to a concert. We're going to a concert tonight. And Alice heard the greats of her day as a result. And that this was so important. I come from the Ozark Mountains, where we didn't have this opportunity. So it was a dream world for me. And then when I read Stefan Zweig's The World of Yesterday, I understood it in a different way, because Zweig wrote about the sense of peace and security they had at a certain time in the early 20th century, that people would calculate their interest for many, many years to come and know how much money they had to retire on and that sort of thing. A world of security we don't have today, where people were polite to each other, and you could count on certain things you believed. As it turned out, it was an illusion, but it was a beautiful world while it lasted. And it was
wow.
a world that people believed in music and art and literature.
What a wonderful time. And the way you describe it in the book, I was taken to that era of time myself, and I was appreciating the feeling that you just described as well of going out and enjoying this beautiful music and the concert, as you describe it so well. Of course, she lived in Europe, and as we all know, that the Nazis, when they invaded, threatened her and her entire livelihood and her family and everyone around her as a Jew, right?
Well, of course. I mean, it happened so quickly. I mean, who could have believed? People were law-abiding. And there were laws against what the Nazis did, but of course they established new laws.
Yeah.
And really, it was extremely difficult to believe. And if people were involved in their lives, as a matter of fact, Netanyahu's youngest brother has written a new play about this, which I hope we will all have an opportunity to see. And it's set in Berlin. In 1933, when Hitler came to power. And most of the play is just people coming to dinner and doing what they usually did, maybe having some music at home, a house concert after dinner. And they discuss, should we stay? Well, it's really terrible. This Hitler came to power, this country bumpkin who has never gone to college. Well, it won't last long. Are we going to stay or leave? Oh, well, William has already left. He fled. He's already in England. And, you know, Renee is in the United States. And the play goes on like that for three acts. And
wow.
In the end, the couple who are doing the entertaining look at each other and say, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to leave? And the woman says, how can we leave? This is our home. And
very powerful.
That's how Hitler took over and did the damage that he did.
Yes, yes. And it's, you know, it's one thing to look back in history to guess it, but to feel what they felt at that time could hardly be explained. You write in the book about life in the concentration camp. Speaking of the concentration camp, of the 156,000 who entered those gates, you said that only 11% survived to liberation.
That's right. In Theresienstadt alone, many people died of typhus. I mean, the sanitary conditions were hideous, and of course there was no food, and there was no medicine. And many of the people were old.
Yes.
But old people and children died the most quickly, and death happened right on the spot just from disease or starvation. But then it was a way station for Auschwitz, so people almost on a weekly basis were transported in cattle cars to Auschwitz and to their death. Very few who were sent either to Auschwitz or to another camp further east, a death camp, didn't manage to survive. Although
right,
they went
right.
straight from the train into the gas chamber.
Yeah, very, very incredible journey and terrible story, as we are all familiar with the Holocaust. But I think the thing that struck me most about what you're talking about here is this facade that the Nazis wanted to put on at this particular concentration camp by hosting the concerts and enjoying and bringing all the artisans and the artists and the accomplished musicians together to have these shows.
It's astonishing. I mean, with hindsight, it's unbelievable. In fact, the first time I visited Theresienstadt, I kept asking the guide, but where were the concerts held?
Yeah.
The guide said, everywhere. But where did you have a concert? Where did they sit? How did this happen? And only much later did I more or less, and from Alice, understand actually how it worked, but it was highly organized. At first, when Alice or anyone else got their deportation papers to Theresienstadt, the very strict rules, you can take so many kilos of luggage. Of course, this is all fake because they sold it from you anyway, but you were allowed to take this many kilos of this, and you could pack this much coffee and so on, but you were not allowed to take musical instruments or music.
Mm.
And I think they saw that as the Nazis probably saw it as a threat. It was could be considered a luxury, and everything was aimed at humiliation and putting people in such a psychological state that they wouldn't have the strength to protest in any way. Just, you know, be completely bent over.
Yeah.
But people did smuggle instruments in, and people did smuggle in occasional scores, and they had concerts from the very beginning. People would get together and sing at night, and whoever had an instrument would play a little bit. And when the Nazis discovered it, I mean, it could have been very severe punishment. It could have been death, even in the early days. But the Nazis quickly realized, gee, what a good show place this would be.
Yes.
And decided to turn it into what they called, I can barely get the words out, Hitler's model concentration camp, which is a thought that is too hideous to even describe.
Yeah.
But that this would be a way to get good propaganda and show the world that the Führer, Hitler, was treating the Jews so very well, and that they were much better off than people in the homeland of Germany who had to live in bombed-out cities. Of course, this was not true. I mean, certainly Germans suffered plenty in the bombings, and women and children who were in the cities, many died, and many didn't have food, many had to climb out of the rubbish. I mean, there was plenty of suffering, but they weren't waiting to be killed because of their religion or their ethnicity.
Well, it's an amazing read from that perspective. And Alice, of course, this accomplished musician, goes in and starts to do these concerts. And in your book, you wrote, what the Nazis failed to understand was that the power of the music to provide comfort and hope to the performers and to their audience was stronger than the terror of their masters. And every composition that was written and every concert played became a moral victory against the enemy. The beauty of their civilization became, for many prisoners, a shield against despair. And indeed, it seemed that the optimism that Alice radiated was spread throughout the camps, and perhaps one of the big reasons why people, like you said, were able to keep some type of hope.
I think so. And I also think it is identity. Here you had people in Nazi uniforms guarding you and starving you and so forth. And yet, you came from a world of beauty, and you came from a world where you had a cozy home, and where you had music, and where you read books, and where you went to lectures, and you were curious, and you studied. So anything that gave you, let you hang on to that memory, I think, was a tremendous help.
Yeah.
I know Friedel Dicker Brandeis was a Bauhaus artist, who ended up in Theresienstadt and later was killed in Auschwitz in 1944. But she saw so many children with nothing to do because they didn't allow Jewish children to go to school. So they didn't have schools. But they did have what they called free time play for children. So she decided she would teach art all day long. And this would be considered free time play because, after all, art wasn't school. It was playtime.
Yeah, yeah.
And what it helped the children immensely, because she told them, don't draw or paint what you see in this terrible place. Paint what you remember.
Mm.
And this is what the concerts did. It was a memory of home, a memory. I mean, I can't imagine. Suppose we were dragged out of our homes and,
no, exactly.
I don't know, made to live in a cesspool somewhere. What would we do? But if you could, just hanging on to the memory of beauty and of what it was, I think really helped people survive.
Caroline, this is just a wonderful story. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will continue this conversation and talk more around how Alice's example and optimism touched your life. This is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson with, of course, our guest today, Caroline Stessinger, and you're listening to Rideau Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about: getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Rideau Recognition Radio. I'm Roy Saunderson and Max Brown, and our guest today, Caroline Stessinger, author of A Century of Wisdom, Lessons from the Life of Alice Herzsommer, the world's oldest living Holocaust survivor. And, you know, as I've seen and looked through the book and different interviews that have happened with Alice, she speaks of her experience in the concentration camp, and she says, how can the child not laugh when the mother laughs? And she also said, I look for the good. I know the bad, but I look for the good. And I'm curious, Caroline, how do you think Alice was able to maintain such a strong sense of optimism throughout her life?
Well, I think, actually, that in the camp, protecting her child was her main goal.
Right.
And she wisely knew, unlike some people feel today, why shouldn't a child experience everything and, you know, this awful term, let it all hang out?
Yeah.
She knew that if the mother cries, if the mother is depressed, the child will be very fearful. And the most she could do for her child, she couldn't provide enough food. That was impossible. She did what she could. but she could keep his psychological spirit alive and the spirit of childhood. So she knew she must invent a kind of fantasy world, which she actually did. And so later, people tell me who met him as an adult, who met her son Raphael, that he would say, "Tell me what was I like in the cab? I don't remember." She actually was able to destroy his memories of it, and she just kept him close to her and warm and safe, and he never saw her once. I don't think he ever saw her down.
Wow. Quite phenomenal.
That gave a child security. I mean, if your house is burning down and your mother is laughing, the child has got to say, "We're going to be safe. We'll have a place to live. It can't be so bad. My mother's laughing," right?
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's quite miraculous, that's for sure. I'm curious.
It's a very simple lesson, but it really works.
Well, it certainly works in this case. Yeah.
Laughter, a smile, makes people feel good.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, she was a great example of that. Now, tell us about this interesting musical, the Bundabar, and how this was carried out right under the noses of the Nazis. It had an allegorical kind of double meaning here. Maybe you can tell us and our audience a little bit more about it.
Bundabar is a fabulous piece. I believe that it's the finest piece ever written for children to perform. It is actually a children's opera. It is entirely sung. I know there are a few spoken words in it, but it's basically all singing. And there is an orchestra accompaniment, which makes it sound much more difficult and much more sophisticated than it really is, because it's easy enough for untrained children that are musically untrained or don't read music that they can sing it and act it out. The basic story, and it was written for the Prague Jewish Orphanage right at the beginning of the war, and rehearsed there initially, but they didn't get to perform it in Prague because the director and many of the children were sent to Theresienstadt before the performance was scheduled and ready. And actually, he reconstructed the orchestration for the accompaniment in Theresienstadt itself. His name was Hans Krause, and he was, I think, probably a genius composer to have accomplished this. But the story basically is of a mother who has two children, and it seems the mother's very ill. They run for the doctor. The doctor says, "I'm sorry, your mother must have bread and milk or she will die." The children have no money. They don't know what to do, so they decide they will sing. They run into the village, and they try to sing, and hopefully the villagers will throw them some coins. But a horrible person comes, Brundibar. And Brundibar plays the accordion and sings much more loudly, and he gets all the attention and the money. Discouraged, the children spend the night in the forest. They fall asleep. The animals cover them and take care of them and tell them not to worry. The next day, they will organize all the children in the surrounding area, and in numbers, there will be strength. This happens, and they get lots of money, and Brundibar appears once again, and he steals the money. The chase ensues, and they capture Brundibar and euphemistically do him in. And they sing a victory song that hold hands, and he who loves mother, father, brother, sister, and our motherland, the enemy is gone, and we have won a victory. In fact, the song's called "We've Won a Victory." Brundibar became a euphemism for Hitler.
Right.
And this was a story of hope, of resistance, of protest all through Theresienstadt. Everybody wanted to see it, not just the parents of the children who were playing on stage. Everybody wanted to see it, and everybody knew the tunes and the words. Now, how did this happen under Hitler, or under the Nazis?
Right, yes.
I believe, and no one has said that I'm wrong, so I think it's probably correct. The children sang in Czech. The words were written in Czech. The Nazis had made a rule that all opera presented in Theresienstadt must be presented in German. Didn't matter if it was originally in Italian or French, it had to be in the German language. But But they made an exception for Brundibar because people explained, well, the children don't know German. They can't learn German so fast. They'll have to sing in Czech. And the Germans thought, well, this is just a scruffy little kid's thing. So they didn't bother to translate it. And they didn't know what they were singing about, and they didn't know the power of this little piece. I think it's absolutely that simple.
Wow, it was brilliant. And it must have been very sustaining for the people there.
Yes, because they did have entire performances of The Bartered Bride, of many operas of Mozart. The German operas were sung in German, but when Mozart wrote in Italian, they had to translate into German. The singers learned the German, and the Dvorak operas had to be sung in German. Everything that they did had to be sung in German under the Nazi rule, just to make it a little more difficult. And, of course, these operas didn't have orchestra accompaniment. They had accompaniment from bad pianos. But the Brundibar Orchestra is a very interesting and strange orchestration. It has 13 instruments. And he based it on the instruments that were available and people that could play them. He found by the time they were ready to perform Brundibar in the camp in 1943, he found two good trumpet players, because the trumpet parts are hard. One was only a 12-year-old boy.
Wow.
And they played trumpets off stage in the Verdi Requiem, and they played the trumpets to this. Found an accordion player, a pianist, a violin. I think there's no second violin part. There's a viola, a cello. It's just a mixture of what they have. But it sounds wonderful. It's rather Kurt Weill-ish, a little bit jazzy. It's just a wonderful, wonderful piece of music. I wish other composers could today compose so well for children to sing.
Well, it was certainly a very inspirational experience, I'm sure, for the children as well as all those in Theresienstadt, for sure. Now, later in your book, Caroline, you quoted Alice speaking about life in the concentration camp, where she said, "We were not competitive. We did our best to support and encourage each other to dream together for our future." Do you think this same bit of wisdom could help solve much of the strife we're continuing to see around the world today?
Of course. I'll give you an example. A new pianist arrived in Theresienstadt who wanted to participate in the concert activity, but she didn't have any music with her, and she wanted to play Bach's Italian Concerto. And another pianist drew the staff lines, made music paper by hand, and from memory wrote down every note of that piece. Now, I play the Italian Concerto. It must be about a piece about 13 minutes long. That's a lot of notes to write down. I mean, how thoughtful, because she could have said, well, you know, we don't have the music, sorry, you can't play. But she understood how much it would mean to this young girl to play and play what she could play. And, of course, it did. And she was very, very grateful. And if statesmen would help each other in the same way with their problems and would respect each other in the same way, so much has to do with respect and not seeing someone as an enemy, not being envious, but finding, as Alice said, finding the good. Where can we? Let's find common ground. It doesn't matter if we talk about a great-grandchild. Find a common ground, something that you can share.
Right.
And I think that's what these musicians did.
Well, Alice also said that music was our food. I always found that fascinating. She said, "This I can say, when we have something spiritual, maybe we don't need food. Music was life. We did not, could not, would not give up." How do you think, Caroline, that we can learn from Alice to appreciate the gifts like music and to never give up?
I think we have to go back to a basic tenet in our civilization, which is respect for life itself, which I believe Alice has in the greatest depth. Respect for life. And if you respect life, you respect all life, and that includes a plant, a butterfly, and you can find beauty in something in nature everywhere. And it makes a tremendous difference when you begin to, when you appreciate the sun that comes up. I remember Bishop Tutu, before the changes in South Africa, saying, someone asked him in a public lecture the question, well, how can you tolerate this? I mean, you're going back to South Africa and there's apartheid and you're not allowed to go to this cafe, and it was like slavery in the United States and you can't do this. And he said, well, you know, we have a beautiful sun in South Africa. I look at the sky. We have a beautiful sunset. We have the sea. We have the wild berries in the fields, and we have the animals, animals that other people on the face of the earth don't ever see. We have a lot to be thankful for. We have a beautiful life. It could be better, and it will be.
Right. Well, I tell you, Caroline, you've captured some wonderful insights from Alice Hurt-Soma's life, and we're going to take a quick break here at this point. But to our listeners, come back in a few minutes on Rideau Recognition Radio as we continue to just talk with our guest today, Caroline Stessinger, more about A Century of Wisdom and the life of Alice Hurt-Soma. For Rideau Recognition Radio, this is Roy Sonneson and Max Brown.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The next generation of employees is more sophisticated about recognition. They want to make a difference to their organizations, to their environment, and to their world. Rideau offers a full suite of recognition and reward solutions tailored to meet our clients' needs strategically, technologically, and globally. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Sonneson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Rideau Recognition Radio with Roy Sonneson and, of course, myself, Max Brown, and our guest, Caroline Stessinger, author of A Century of Wisdom, Lessons from the Life of Alice Hurt-Soma, the world's oldest living Holocaust survivor, and might I add, an accomplished musician and an example for all of us in terms of her optimism. In fact, you know, Caroline, as I hear you talking with Roy in that last segment, I wonder what stands out for you during your interviews and your time that you were able to spend with Alice?
That's a very interesting and good question. There's so much. We could spend an hour on that. But I would say, in brief, her unsullied sweetness, her incredible and insatiable curiosity, her youthful spirit, and her ability, she's genuinely interested in other people. She's the most democratic person that I have ever met or hope to meet, because she genuinely doesn't make a difference in people. If the Queen of England came to her door, she would behave no differently from the garbage collector coming.
Wonderful.
She is true, and it's not a pretense.
No.
As some people could do. It's very genuine, and she would be just as interested and the local beggar, as she would be in the Queen. She's often the youngest person in the room in spirit. Younger people will say they're so tired or it's too difficult. I mean, younger people, you know, only 70 and 80 years old. And she will try them and tell them, it's not so bad, it's not so difficult. Now you should do this or do that. Alice is always capable of looking forward. She is, I mean, even at 108, and I would say that at this moment, she's 108 and a quarter.
Oh.
She's well into her 109th year. And she looks forward to each day. Each day for her is a miracle and a gift. Can I mention a poem of actually John Greenleaf Whittier that really describes her philosophy? He wrote, "No longer forward nor behind I look in hope or fear, but grateful, take the good I find, the best of now and here."
Wow, that's wonderful.
Can I inject a little tiny bit of humor?
Please.
We think of romance as belonging to the young, and I think we have prejudice in that area. When I first met her with a Czech TV crew, the Czech director and the cameraman were, you know, 6 feet tall or so, and Alice is about 4 feet six, and they were young and good-looking, you know, early 30s, and she hadn't expected this. So when I arrived, she was dressed very nicely and neatly, and she was wearing white sneakers. But when she saw these two young men, she quickly disappeared. And when she returned, she was wearing red sneakers. She always wears sneakers. She has a wardrobe of sneakers. Red sneakers. She had put beads around her neck and red lipstick on.
Wow.
And the rest of the filming session, she either held their hands, she patted their cheeks. She's a real flirt. It was just amazing. She came to life so spontaneously and so with such energy. And then I saw something else that nearly broke my heart.
Mm.
We had been with her for at least a week every day. And when we were finally leaving, we said, you know, our farewells and presents were exchanged inside her little apartment. And we went out the door. And then all of a sudden she appeared at the door again. She said, "Oh, just a minute, I'll come to the lobby with you." She walked through the lobby with us. And there are two huge glass doors in front of the stairway and about 13 stone steps down to the floor. She stood at that glass door as we walked down the steps. Our taxi was waiting for us, and she was waving as far as the eye could see. I wanted to go back and just, you know, wrap her in cotton wool and take care of her for the rest of her life. And that was my emotion. And she waved as long as we could possibly see her.
I am so grateful to hear this whole experience. I'm in my mind's eye, I'm picturing this experience you just had, driving away, watching her wave and her smile and ability to be so optimistic despite the life experiences. You mentioned in the book, you know, that when they had to go to the concentration camps, not only did they give everything up in terms of physical possessions, including her treasured piano, but the people just came through her house knowing that she was going to be going away and would take things and say, "Well, we will hold on to them for you," you know, knowing that, you know, someday when you come back, we will give them back. And then knowing, you know, most people just kind of led this life thinking, well, we know we'll never see them again. Of course, her husband was separated and they didn't ever see him again. But her and her son did survive. And when they went back, people were living in their old apartment and all their things were gone. And because of all this, you talk about her, she had this sense of, why do I need so many things in my life? Which she still does today. Is that correct? Like, it's a very simple life in terms of the possession she has. And yet she's so full and so rich.
She learned what she could live without. She constantly says, "I'm the richest person in the world. I'm richer than the richest person because I have music in my life. I have music in my heart. I have music in my mind, in my ears, and in my soul." And she had lived without I mean, she had nothing. And it is true, when Primo Levi went to Auschwitz and came back, he was able to go back to his own home in Italy and his old job as if nothing had happened. He'd just been away in prison for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Not so with the Czechs or for Alice. When she went back, someone had confiscated her apartment. Anyone that had taken her things couldn't be found. She had no money. The Nazis had taken her bank account. And the government, which was being taken over by the communists at that time, did nothing to stop this. It was a terrible, terrible time. And she's always made good decisions for herself, however, because she really wanted to stay. Prague was her home.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to stay, but she was encouraged to leave for Israel. And after she waited till the last moment, Israel was already a state, and she didn't leave for Israel or get her papers in order until 1949. And by that time, she was just very lucky that she got out of the country, or she would have been behind the Iron Curtain in a different kind of prison for another 40 years.
Yes. Yes. Caroline, can we personalize this for a moment? Oh, I'm sorry, please.
I'm sorry?
Oh, I thought I had missed a comment there. I thought if we could personalize it for a moment, how has this experience changed your own life? How do you respond differently now when life throws challenges your way?
I really think of Alice every day. And when something that I would normally complain about or maybe get a little depressed about, I think, mm-hmm. it's nothing. You know, I'm wasting my time.
Mm.
And also, I had a terrible experience a year ago. It's just a year ago this month that my only child, a beautiful, brilliant daughter, that many of you may have read her article in the New York Times, actually, was diagnosed with stomach cancer.
Mm.
And, I mean, nothing more catastrophic really could happen to me. I could lose everything material. It wouldn't make any difference. But for my child to be faced with this, and it was stage 3, probably stage 3 plus, and I knew what we were facing. And I saw how brave she was, and I thought about Alice. I thought, you know, there's no time for tears. This is absolutely not allowed. We have to act, and we have to act now. And the day she was diagnosed, we got to the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and within 3 days, she was already in chemotherapy and starting the treatment. And she mainly, because she is very brave. We just went through it as if, you know, this is what you do. And I think that's what the musicians in Theresienstadt did. They practiced a little bit, and they played concerts. That's what they did. Here we had to fight a disease with all of our strength, and there was no time for tears or sadness or anything like that, because I've learned that from Alice. It doesn't help. It makes other people feel bad. What if my daughter had seen me cry? That would have made her feel much worse. Actually, a child in Theresienstadt wrote a poem. It was in the child didn't sign her name to it. We know it was a girl because she said, I'm a girl. And so she was probably very young. And the poem is like this. It just, a loose translation from the Czech is, I won't be sad today. No. I can be sad tomorrow, but today I won't be sad. And Alice and I have talked about that poem a great deal, and it's very simple, but it's something to live by, because if you allow yourself to descend into sadness and despair, you lose time that you could be celebrating life and living life, even under the worst and most awful circumstances. This is not PAP. This is reality.
Wow.
I know, because I've been there.
Yes. Well, and my goodness, to hear your own personal examples of trials that will come and hit all of us in different ways. Can I ask you, what advice would you give to leaders who influence and impact the lives of others as a result of this book and perhaps the experiences you've had as well?
I would like to tell all of them to practice democracy in their hearts and to listen to people that they believe are their enemies and to have respect for whomever they're speaking with. And even if it's someone they believe is a terrible person or has done dreadful things, still find something to respect. Alice, who bases basically her whatever religious belief she has on and philosophical beliefs on Spinoza, is that no one is 100% good or 100% bad. And we've known some pretty bad people in the 20th century and in the 21st. And I think a leader must find some kind of common ground with anyone he has to deal with. I don't think that they should start to fight and be bullies and go to war as a result. Because just as Alice will say constantly, I don't hate anyone, hatred only leads to hatred, and war only leads to war. This is what I would tell world leaders.
Carolyn, thank you for this segment. We have to take another break, but when we come back, we'll come back with that last segment and some final ideas on this experience you've had with this book, maybe with your own life as well. We're sure grateful you'd be with us today. And for Rideau Recognition Radio, this is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson reminding you to keep it real. We'll be right back with our guest, Caroline Stessinger. Don't go away.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Rideau Recognition Radio. We're going to finish off our conversation today with Caroline Stessinger, our guest, and learn some final pointers on a century of wisdom and dealing with the oldest living Holocaust survivor, Alice Hertz-Zoma. Caroline, this has been just a remarkable interview, just hearing the insights you've gained about Alice's life. If there's anything you wished you would have known earlier in your life, what would it be based on what you've experienced through this wonderful experience of connecting with Alice?
I think I would have listened to her more about practicing life, not being afraid to try anything that was reasonable, learning as the top most important thing in life. I think my teenage years would certainly have been less traumatic if I had known Alice and known her wisdom during that time. Patience. And Alice stresses a love to work, which I did find, and which we share, practice, and I would like to say this for anyone that studies music or anything, practice is not it's not a chore. Mm-hmm. It's work, but it's work you love, and it's something that is very important. And if you love to work, actually, it's a great survival skill that Alice taught me. It doesn't matter if you have to do the dishes or polish the floor. If you can actually enjoy it and take satisfaction in a job well done, whatever it is, the most menial task to the most difficult, you will certainly be a much happier person.
And Alice certainly speaks of having a great deal of gratitude for life. And she talks about, I never give up hope. What gives you hope for the future?
I hoped for a life that I had created in my mind. As I say, I grew up in the Ozark Mountains, so I knew very little of the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
And I created expectations which were probably unreal in many ways. I also believe that I was at fault, and I would caution anyone about this, to think that we can expect anything, or that that there is anything in this world that is secure, that we don't know the next moment what can happen to us. And living in the moment and keeping our minds and hearts pure and caring about other people is really all that matters. And not wasting time on anything negative, and certainly not on negative emotions.
Well, that's very powerful. For our listeners' benefit, we want to make sure we give them an opportunity. If they wanted to reach out and find out more, how could they connect or learn more about what you do and your experiences with Alice?
They could go to my website called The Mozart Academy, just themozartacademy.com, and they can write to me there. Or we have a website, which is facebook.com/Alice's, plural, fans. Alice's fans.
Well, I think you've gained a lot more of Alice's fans through this wonderful interview today. Thank you for sharing what you have.
I hope people will understand her. Alice is so important, not just because she's 108 on the way to 109. It's not just because she was a great pianist, not just an ordinary pianist. She was a great, phenomenal pianist and still plays extremely well. It's not because she was in a concentration camp. It's all of this combined. It's her background, her knowledge of literature, her friendship with Franz Kafka and other greats of the world, Golda Meir in Israel. It is what she took from the life that came her way. She didn't choose it. It was there, and she made the best of it and has lived a very, very miraculous life, really, and shared her smiles with the whole world. And anyone who comes in her presence is truly blessed.
Well, wonderful. Thank you for capturing that whole image and experience and her philosophy in your book. If there was one final thought or piece of advice that you would give our audience today from a century of wisdom, what would you say to them?
I believe, as a parting word, I would say, remember to be generous in spirit at all times, with yourself and with others.
That's lovely. Lovely. Thank you for capturing that for us and for our audience. And Caroline, we would like to thank you for being on our show today. It's been a wonderful experience for us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for making such a wonderful interview and asking great questions and giving and sharing Alice's story with your audience. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'm sure she does, too.
Wonderful.
Well, we'd like to thank you again and thank our audience for tuning in, and we invite you to tune in to our next show, where Max and I will be continuing our discussion on how to build relationships, inspire greatness, and create a workplace where people can thrive. Max and I welcome and encourage your comments and suggestions. Simply go to rido.com/radio. That's RIDEAU.com/radio to give us your feedback and tell us why you listen to Rido Recognition Radio. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening to Rido Recognition Radio. For more information about the Rido Recognition Institute, visit us at rido.com. Until next time, this is Roy Saunderson and Max Brown reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Saunderson and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for more motivational tips to help your employees perform better. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.